Are we having fun with the teal book? A young boy was in a Christmas pageant at church and had one line to memorize. He was to stand and say, "I am the light of the world." This, of course, comes from something purportedly said by Jesus. However, on the night of the production, he froze at the sight of so many people and forgot his line. His mother was seated on the front row and began mouthing his line for him. Following her cue, he said, "My mother is the light of the world." Such innocence. It is in such innocence that the light of the world truly comes through, however. Not in one person only, but in all people and in all of life. This is the message, it seems to me, of the Gnostic Gospels that we talked about a few weeks ago. Moreover, Carol Pearson, author of the work The Hero Within, which will be the basis for a Lifespan course that we will be starting in February on mythology, uses Carl Jung's notion of archetypes to say that one of the primary forms of identity in Western culture is the innocent. And Brock and Parker, in their work Saving Paradise, seem to me to discuss innocence in terms of paradise. It is an innocence, however, that is fully aware of tragedy, of pain, of fear, and of death. In full acknowledgement of human suffering, the primary image and message of Christianity in the first millennium of its history was paradise in this world. Jesus is seen in the early churches as a child, a young man, a shepherd, an innocent living in paradise, and never on the cross as the crucified Son of God. This crucifixion-centered image comes about in the second millennium of Christian history and remains with us to this very day. Traditional Christianity lost paradise and instead invoked images and theologies that promulgated violence. So in the second millennium, Christianity became crucifixion-centered rather than paradise-centered. In the first 1,000 years, the death of Jesus in agony on the cross was not at all prevalent or relevant. But that changed in the second millennium, and in essence, Jesus died again. What is fascinating is that the dead body of Jesus on the cross is first found in Northern Europe in the Köln Cathedral in Germany. The earliest surviving crucifix, with a life-sized Jesus hanging almost naked on the cross with a sunken face and closed eyes, is known as the Gero Cross. It was sculpted from oak in Saxony, now Germany, sculpted in the latter half of the 10th century. Depictions of the crucified Christ proliferated in Europe in the 11th century and became increasingly grotesque and bloody. By the end of the medieval period, Jesus was routinely displayed being tortured. Christians turned from a vision of paradise in this life to a focus on the crucifixion and final judgment. Images of terror, torture, and the desolation of the earth came to permeate the religious imagination of Western Christianity. There seems to be a number of factors involved in this dramatic change, one of which was a missionary effort on the part of Charles Martel, which was continued by his grandson, Charlemagne. Remember in your history classes, or at least in my history class, Charles Martel was a hero who stopped the Muslims at the Battle of Tours, and Charlemagne was the hero who solidified Europe. But in fact, Martel, Charlemagne, and the warrior aristocrats known as the Carolingians did their missionary work through the sword. Charlemagne's tactics against the Saxons is considered to be one of the most brutal pages in the history of Christian missionary efforts in Europe. Ironically, the Saxons had already adopted Christianity, but not the correct type that was taught by the Carolingians. For the Saxons practiced a mixture of pagan nature religion centered on holy trees and sacred springs, along with some of the Christian rituals such as baptism. Charlemagne's campaigns against the Saxons, that is, his desire to subdue the Saxons to the, again, correct form of Christianity, resulted in the destruction of their shrines, of their sacred trees, including essentially the deforestation of Germany, as well as in the death of thousands and thousands of Saxons. Charlemagne saw his victories over the Saxons as being comparable to Jesus' defeat of death through his crucifixion and resurrection. And so his military victories replicated divine salvation. It is this kind of thinking that leads easily to empire building, colonization, the dehumanization of others, and incredible violence, all of which we see today on a daily basis as well. On the other hand, the cross, once a sign of life in paradise, became, from the victim's perspective, a symbol of terror. And so the Saxons created a complex symbol, the Gero cross, showing the crucified Jesus suffering as they had suffered. In public, the Gero cross acknowledged their submission to Carolingian Christianity and the judgmental Christ. In their hidden lives, however, the Saxons' Gero cross symbolized resistance and their kinship with the suffering Christ, who too died at the hands of an oppressor. And yet this complex symbol will lose its original meaning and become the icon of a victorious Holy Roman Empire. What this meant was a major shift in the Christian prohibition against the shedding of blood. For centuries, the church had taught that participation in warfare was actually evil, that killing broke the fifth commandment, and that soldiers were to perform penance to cleanse their souls from the stain of blood. At the dawn of the Holy Roman Empire, Christianity began to lose its grip on the sinfulness of killing. A new age began, one in which the execution of Jesus would become a sacrifice to be repeated in the ravages of a full-blown holy war. In 1095, Pope Urban II called for a peace council in Clermont, France. But this is not the kind of peace council that you and I would imagine. Pope Urban II beseeched those listening to him to take up arms, to go to Jerusalem and, quote, attack the bastard Turks. These anti-Muslim sentiments led to the First Crusade. And the motivation for people to go, Pope Urban proclaimed, whoever goes on the journey to free the Church of God in Jerusalem can substitute the journey for all penance of sin. And he advocated righteous warfare as a form of love. For it is charity to risk your life for your brother. What Urban did, which again we see all too often today by both the nation state and religious fanatics, is to make war a devotional activity, an act of God's salvation. Urban continued the process of reversing 1,000 years of Christian teaching against killing. Instead of being a sin, Urban declared war to be a way, actually, to atone for sin. It was a path to paradise, where paradise was something now apart from this life, rather than within this life in the material world. And thus the Western Church began integrating violence into its own heart by sanctifying it. But this violence against others, symbolized by the crucified Christ, rather than the resurrected Jesus of paradise, was not simply a matter of historical events, that took place by power-hungry individuals and groups. Theologians added to the mess. And admittedly, sometimes theology is messed up. Archbishop Anselm of Canterbury is considered one of the great scholastic theologians of the Middle Ages. It is he who solidifies the tendency in the church to see Jesus as willing himself to die for the sins of humankind. Sinners bore both the burden of repayment for their sins and the original sinfulness of human nature. And so God had to pay for the debt by becoming incarnate and dying on the cross. Anselm's theology of atonement, a theology that I was immersed in as well as a Baptist, and so it is not something found in Catholicism only, provides the religious foundation for the Crusades, for all holy war. For killing and being killed imitated the gift of Christ's death, the anguish of his self-sacrifice, and the terror of his judgment. The theology of atonement allows for an image of God as judgmental and violent, lending support to contemporary times, to war, as well as to domestic violence. Even Bernard of Clairvaux and Hildegard of Bingen, both mystics, preached widely in support of crusading as a religious vocation. For Bernard, the crusade forged a new form of love, ecstatic union with Christ's suffering in life and death. Sufferings which he called sweet, and torture which he eroticized, were integral to his ideas of love and salvation. He essentially married Eros to Mars, making love and death, ecstasy and war, intimately related to one another. We have only to recall our own holy crusades in Iraq and Afghanistan, and pictures of Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay, and so on and so on, to realize that this kind of theology, mythology, thinking, and violence remain quite alive and quite potent. I am convinced, however, that this is not what life is meant to be, and that we in the West took a wrong turn 1,000 years ago that can still be reversed. Actually, we preserve it here in UU congregations. I am convinced that all religions, including traditional Christianity, have within them the seeds of wisdom, Sophia, to find paradise again. And so I wish to use a different Christian image rather than the crucified Jesus on the cross to suggest the potency and innocence of paradise. And that is the newborn child. The birth of Jesus, the nativity, with loved ones and strangers alike surrounding the baby, exemplify the innocence, vulnerability, unity, and beauty of life in this world and in the present. The birth of any child is the birth of life itself, affirming the vibrancy and holiness of being. The gift of all children is the gift of paradise. For we acknowledge that each child's birth is a miracle and that the newborn baby is sacred. And none of us has lost this. For within us is also another archetype, and that is the divine child. Although Christmas has passed, the miracle of birth is part of life always. May we commit ourselves to finding paradise by seeing the holy in all people, including ourselves, and by seeing the sacred in all of life. May it be so, and blessed be. Amen. Appropriately, let us sing hymn number 409, Sleep, My Child. 409.